Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Raditya, your host for this episode, and today we are joined by Dr. Yanis Gaitonidis, who is currently assistant professor at Chiba University, to talk about his latest monograph, Spirituality and Alternativity in Contemporary Japan, Beyond Religion? There's a question mark at the end of that title. Before we get into the book, can we get a short sort of self-introduction about you and maybe your work for sort of a few minutes?
Sure. Thank you for having me, first of all. I think this is my first podcast, so I'll try to be as good as I would like to be on the podcast. Since last year, actually, I'm an associate professor, not that it matters much, but at Chiba University, and I have been in Japan for the last 10 years or so, since I finished my PhD at the University of Leeds in 2011. And I've been working on, let's say, alternative therapies and people who make a business out of it, full-time or part-time. And I have also, in the meantime, also looked into the history of such therapies in Japan. I have also looked into topics such as occultism and esotericism and how such concepts apply perhaps to outside of the European, mostly European context in which they were developed. So all kinds of contemporary things that, let's say, go out or are located outside established institutionalized, organized religion in Japan. I think that's it, basically.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you for sharing that. So this book explores spirituality in sort of contemporary Japan by examining sort of three important facets of sort of this phenomenon. Sort of the therapist, the sort of the spiritual therapist, scholars, or sort of academia, and the publishing industry. And I think this is a very fascinating approach that not a lot have taken. But before we jump sort of into the contents of the book, can you share some of the origins of sort of the book? What got you interested in sort of the topic, and how did this sort of book come to be?
Sure. Basically, a lot of the data was collected for my doctoral work at the University of Leeds. So a lot of the interviews, originally the interviews were done in mostly in the year 2008, 2009. And after I finished the PhD, and by 2012, I had already published some of the arguments in about four papers. So between 2010 and 2012, a lot of what I say in the PhD had been come out, let's say, in individual papers. So this is not my PhD, basically. This is not my doctoral thesis, and it would be unfair to publish a thesis 12 years later or something. So, but what happened is that between 2012 and when I started writing this, I think a lot of things have changed. And perhaps to put it more clearly, actually 2012 is a very interesting year. And if you think about what came out that year, I think you had the special issue on religions after Ohm, I think in the Japanese Journal of Religious Studies, edited by Erika Baffelli and Ian Reeder, which made a lot of interesting points about the state of the field of religious studies. There's an interesting article by Ben Dorman on a scholarship after Ohm. There was also 2012 was also the year that Jason Josephson published his book, The Invention of Religion, which put a lot into question, right, in terms of how do we think about the concepts in of course in historical perspective, but even today I think it has a lot of relevance for contemporary discussions, even if it's not, the book is not about contemporary Japan. There is also Jolyon Thomas also had his first book out, Drawing on Tradition. I think that was also 2012, and that finally did something that was very important, I think, which was to criticize this idea that we can find in media and anime and stuff like that, essentially Japanese spirituality or something like that. So he provided a very, very important criticism at the time that we couldn't find elsewhere. And also another book that came out in 2012 was Uta Hanegraaff's book, which was trying to frame in European terms the study of esotericism as a kind of coming out of a particular rejection, let's say, of certain historical events and persons in the study of religion, which is something that he has basically associated with the importance of the study of esotericism in Europe. But I think what for me was more important was his criticism of religionism, this way of looking at religion as something changing and shifting through time, but at the same time as something that has an essence that remains unchanged. And he criticized people like, of course, Mircea Eliade and others before and after him for espousing this particular approach to the study of religion. So for me, and there are other books also, I can say a bit more about that, that 2012 was kind of a year that I had all these papers out and all these new ideas coming on, and I started thinking about how to reframe my study in a book. And this is, I think I mentioned this in my book, that my first plan of the monograph dates from 2012. To answer your question, that was a very long answer, but to answer your question, basically, the book, it took 10 years because I had to, first of all, look at what happened and all these therapies after the so-called spiritual boom or whatever, and after, I mean, on a longer term, to find out how does the life develop and how does their ideas about what they're doing changes through the years. And I also had to find a way to place all my interest, particularly in terms of how the study of religion should be also the study of things that are contributing to the construction of what we think religion is, such as healthcare and, in the book at least, therapy and economic precarity and all these things that I think need as much analysis as whatever we call religion. So it took more time, basically, than I had thought. But I think I got there.
Yeah, indeed. There's so much packed into sort of this monograph that I feel like the title makes it seem as if it's actually a lot more simple than what the contents are, because there's so much things you're talking about here. And I guess, you know, when you're working on sort of a topic that's contemporary, within that 10-year period, a lot has changed, right? Like Civicon that you sort of mentioned in the book too, that has sort of changed form and like the names changed too. Okay, so let's start by talking about this term, spirituality. And it's a very loaded term, as you've sort of touched upon in sort of the introduction and in most of the book as well. But it's often discussed in conjunction with or sort of as an alternative to religion. But you're sort of taking a slightly different approach in sort of this book here. Can you perhaps talk a little bit more about this? Sort of what is the history behind sort of this term, I guess specifically in Japan, and sort of how do you understand this term in your research and how do you sort of use it?
Right. Basically, how I started rethinking my original research was to look into how and why scholars started using the term. I think that was quite important for me to frame the entire book, actually, even if I only spend a chapter on scholarly discourse on spirituality. It actually helped me to find out how scholars talk about it, precisely because until actually much later, I mean, even in the mid-2010s, so perhaps about 10 years ago, if you wanted to find read a book about contemporary spirituality in Japan, let's say, that was accessible, I was talking about what was happening in the previous decade, so in the 2000s, what was this so-called spiritual boom, etc. You had to rely on, perhaps you know that book, Isomura Kentaro's, a journalist's book on which is about precisely the spiritual boom. And if you look carefully into that book, you realize that he mentions so many of the research, Shimazu no Susumu and Ito Hirofumi and people who had published about spirituality before or during those, I mean, in the early years of the 21st century. So I realized that it was so important to try to find out that this kind of loop that I describe eventually in the book between scholars writing about spirituality and journalists reading about spirituality and talking about it. And then, of course, the therapists who perhaps don't read scholarly works that often, but are also engulfed in these descriptions of this thing that is supposed to be new. So the starting point for me was really to try to understand how spirituality in katakana became a kind of keyword to try to grasp whatever was this contemporary religiosity that scholars were talking about. And the point that I focus on in the book was the creation of association for the study of religion and society, the Shūkyō to Shakai Gakkai, right? That preceded the OM affair, but in its first years and towards, I mean, the late 1990s, it was entirely almost occupied with this idea of spirituality, and even before that, the Seishin Sekai, the spiritual world, this category of books. And I looked in the proceedings of the workshops they had, from which came out a lot of the books that considered spirituality in scholarly terms later, and to see how scholars started shifting from religion as a term to understand contemporary religion to trying to include New Age movement and the Seishin Sekai into the discussion, and to later actually trying to say that, well, I mean, we really need a new term to try to account for all this is happening, and adopting spirituality as a term for the study. So for me, the term spirituality is something that in the book, at least I locate in the late 90s, but of course you can find it early on, even in the late 1980s, in translations of transpersonal psychology books into Japanese, where it appears again, but it's not used in a scholarly analysis. It's not in the same way that it doesn't carry the weight that it will have later in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you. So in chapter one, you focus on the sort of the spiritual therapist through your own sort of encounters, your field work with sort of these practitioners, but also through sort of secondary scholarship. And you're trying to push back against sort of this notion that these therapists are so preoccupied with the spiritual adjective and that they are, well, first and foremost, therapists. But can you elaborate more on that? How do these sort of therapists understand their own practice?
Right. So the therapists that I encountered, it's important to say that most of them, I encountered them, as I say, towards the end of the so-called boom, right? This media kind of attention and focus on this term, the spirituality, and this figure of Ehara Hiroyuki. So when I counted them, and that's how I found them, was through the use of this keyword, spiritual, and then therapy. They associated what they did and described what they did by using that term in mostly in reference to what their clients would know about that term. And this is most obviously this TV personality of Ehara Hiroyuki. But also, and this is where it was important to actually wait longer to actually write about them in a book, that term spiritual tended after a few years to actually be replaced by something else, dropped out, or the meaning associated with it or what they meant by it tended perhaps also to shift. So some people might use it originally as something to talk about, you know, spirits and past life and things like that. And later they would perhaps change their minds and focus more on how spiritual is about the self and the state of a kind of state of a good self and developed self and things like that. So for scholars, spirituality and spiritual is particularly as an adjective changed and shifted as media also perhaps lost interest in this particular term, and as more and more other terms or perhaps other publications or other kinds of therapies came into Japan or were developed within Japan from the mid-2000s until more recently.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I also find personally really interesting. And just sort of with sort of my own work with sort of the anime polygon, which phenomenon, the sort of Seichi Junrei thing, there's something very similar with, like, you have all these associations, sort of all these research groups that, you know, not only include sort of scholars, but also journalists and sort of people from the media and people from the tourism industry, and sort of they influence one another as they sort of try to understand what this thing is. And it's interesting to see that something similar has sort of happened with sort of spirituality and sort of the spiritual therapists as well. And I guess while we're sort of in that topic, let's move on to chapter two, where you sort of explore the role of the sort of academia and sort of the scholars in constructing sort of this discourse in spirituality. It's a very reflexive look, right? Sort of this phenomenon, you know, looking at the scholars as well, who are sort of shaping, you know, sort of this thing. And you mentioned figures like, you know, earlier Shimazu no Suzumu, for example. Can you maybe give us an overview of how their work or maybe their interaction with sort of this discussion of spirituality influenced public discourse and understanding on the topic?
Right. Well, I think, to be honest, in this time and age of, you know, social networks, etc., if we talk about the contemporary topic, not just religion, but in general, I think it's almost always necessary to include a kind of reflective section of how scholars engage, right, with the topic, and how since, you know, in some way, particularly for scholars who are very active on Twitter, for example, or in other media, you know, traditional newspaper media and journals, but also on social media, I think it's inevitable that, you know, scholarship and scholarly arguments you know, propagated in many ways, perhaps also sometimes misinterpreted, etc., and influence public opinion, obviously. This is a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, that regardless of that, it's not just spirituality, but I think any kind of topic really needs, in contemporary terms, to deal with this aspect. And that's exactly also how I thought about this, not in terms of, okay, let's criticize the older guys to say something new, obviously. But it's more about this. Some of these researchers on spirituality have been very prolific, which is always obviously a good thing. But I was trying to find out the degree to which, I mean, their arguments may have changed. And I was surprised sometimes that some of these arguments have not changed for the 20 or 30 years. They may have been used in the same kind of different vocabulary, but the message is perhaps there. And I think we all have some kind of message. I would like to think that maybe in 10 years my message is different, but who knows? But at least I think every scholar has some kind of thing, right, to get through their scholarship. But in the case of spirituality, I think the critique of, you know, the study of new religions and the study of spirituality and had focused very much on methodology and, you know, and how the Ohm affair had shown that religious studies scholars and had done it wrong, basically. And although I'm not engaging that particular argument, I use that argument to say that, well, have they really changed after Ohm? Because a lot of the scholars of spirituality studies, their motivation to use that term and to focus on non-institutionalized or non-established, let's say, religious practices was that they felt that things had gone wrong before, right? As I described in chapter two. And I wanted to find out, had they really managed that? And I think to my, let's say, my results show that, well, I don't think they really had changed their methods. They still, of course, they looked at things that previous regenerations of scholars hadn't, but they still kind of had this idea that there's this evolutionary frame in which religion is pushed, is kind of thrown into as going through various stages, and the apex of that stage, the most recent format of that is spirituality. But under that frame, there is this unchanging, very kind of ossified essence of this kind of popular religion that is hidden, and that is kind of appears in different periods under different kind of shapes. And it used to be new religions, and now it's spirituality. And I thought that yes, perhaps they have, after Ohm, they scholars of religion looked into different and newer things that hadn't been analyzed before, but their approach remained the same. They looked for this kind of essence that that also has some kind of salvific and therapeutic powers, at least to kind of change society, or to even after 3.11 particularly, to actually to promote a better better communities and a more kind of a collaboration between institutions and religious institutions and general society. So that's basically the argument of chapter two, is this: have really anything changed after all? Maybe not. Something like that.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I certainly sort of feel something similar when I read just, you know, any work on sort of religious studies tutors. Every time like a new approach comes out, there seems to sort of still be this underlying feeling of maybe not really nostalgia, but like as you sort of you mentioned before, like that there's something that's faith the same, like all these new forms that we're seeing right now, they're new, but there's something that sort of remains there. Yeah, it is interesting. And I mean, I guess if you sort of think about you know, this podcast too, right? Like maybe someone interested in sort of this business, and maybe they might come and this is, you know, they sort of listen to sort of our conversation, and that might influence their thoughts and sort of the way they do things as well. Yeah. Okay. So and sort of moving on to sort of chapter three, where you sort of discuss the publishing industry and sort of its role in sort of this entire spirituality culture. And it's sort of interesting because as you've sort of pointed out in sort of this chapter as well, despite sort of print materials, all these books playing such an important role, there's barely any discussion on the people behind them. So, you know, you interview some of the editors, the translators. From sort of these sort of interviews that you've had with them, how do they sort of understand Seishin Sekai, right, sort of this category? What are some of their concerns and their interest in the topic?
Right, so this particular category that was very much, I mean, there is a lot of that hasn't gone into this chapter that, I mean, for problems of space, actually, this chapter used to be double the size, and the one I had to cut a lot. My wonderful copy editor, Jane Capel, helped me out, cut some of this stuff, but there was so much stuff that could be put into it because of the work of the translators do, and some of the editors in the 70s and 80s, I think, established a lot of what we consider today as Seishin Sekai. And I mean, in this particular, in the book, what eventually came out in the publication, one of the key arguments is that some of the publishers of these books in the late 1970s and 1980s, which later became labeled or already were labeled perhaps also as Seishin Sekai, did not consider those books as particularly religious or of a kind of new age or things like that, but they were placing them in a longer history of publications that were supposed to help you, you know, get a better life or find solutions to issues that you may have with your business, with your family, etc., etc. So they were in a sense finding that. Especially in the 60s and 70s, when the publishing market in Japan kind of had its really the so-called really a golden age of because there was so much stuff going on and a lot of small publishers coming out, they were trying to find, of course, niche publications, and some of that had to do with this literature of famous people or people who had were not famous but had been very successful in life, and that had a particular way of talking about their lives or interpreting what happened to them. Well, those people were published, so they published these particular publications as a and some of them were basically what we would say later New Agers, if you want, or people who had also some particular experiences or had a let's say, out of the world perspective on life. So that's the idea that these publishers were not really, I was trying to say that they were not really alternative, but they were basically that placed them in a longer history that goes back perhaps even to in the 19th century of publishers that focused on popular books that were supposed to help readers kind of get through their problems, if you want. And later in the 90s, this became a really kind of category, right? The jiko keihatsu bon, the self-development books that we find often in bookshops. But I think that there was the Seishin Sekai is only kind of a small section of a larger category that has a longer history than what we attribute it to today. That's the gist of the chapter, I think.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah, thank you. Interesting. All right, so chapter 5 is sort of really important to talk about because these sort of practitioners, sort of these spiritual therapists, I feel like they've always been sort of portrayed by the media, but also by scholars to a certain extent, as sort of marginalized figures. And sort of in this chapter, you discuss precarity sort of in this spiritual business. So I'll ask a somewhat complicated question to answer. What does precarity mean to you? And from your conversation with sort of this sort of therapist, how do they see precarity themselves?
Right. So yes, this is the second section of the book, right? So
yeah,
the book is it's built
divided into
sections.
Two parts, right? Which you should have mentioned. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, just that's okay. I mean, it's just that. So the first three chapters are more about discourse, and the next three chapters are more about perhaps practice and in particular how the lives of these spiritual therapists. And I found as example I mentioned in the very introduction, that many of the therapists live in a sense a precarious life in terms of the salons are, as I mentioned, are most of the time not very successful. They don't really manage to to get through more than a year or maybe 2 years. And those who are successful are really good actually and managing obviously businesses, because they are the small business owners, right? And so if we think in those terms, it's very easy to understand how precarious this sector is. If you think of small business owners in general in this particular state of the economy, especially after the 2008 crisis, etc., etc. So I understand precarity in that sense, obviously. I also understand precarity in the sense of, and I place them in the sense of how they consider their clients, obviously, as precarious also, that they have these issues with work, with family, and how what they do, the therapists, what they do with their clients kind of helps their clients to go through these precarious moments in life. So in a kind of wider sense of precarity. And I also link this with the gender aspect, right? The fact that a lot of the therapists are women who went out of company jobs or other kinds of relatively lucrative jobs sometimes and quit those jobs because, in their own words, they didn't have any, they couldn't see a future, a career. They experienced all kinds of difficulties, including harassment, etc. And they moved into this particular sector of this spiritual therapy sector with a hope that this would change. But then, of course, they would also face all the kinds of precarities, including the problem that within this particular sector, there was also this kind of gender divide with, some women being labeled as more prone to be good therapists and men not, and all these kind of expectations that clients had on what women therapists were supposed to be able to do, etc., etc. So there was this precarity in that sense as well. Okay, that's the short answer, let's say.
Yeah, okay. I think this is why an ethnographic sort of approach is really important when it comes to something like this. Because, if you just sort of focus on sort of, materials and sort of books and stuff like that, in contrast to sort of this precarity and sort of this business, there's all these sort of, again, media portrayals of like therapists and sort of everyone really in sort of the spiritual business as like, they're just trying to make as much profit as they can, like they're making a lot of money from like all these sort of sessions by basically, like fooling people and everything. And there's like the association of lawyers against what is it, spiritual business or something like that? I can't quite remember the Japanese
spiritual
term.
Sales, yes.
Yeah, spiritual sales, right. So sort of just for our listeners who are not sort of familiar with like the condition here in Japan, there's a lot happening with that. But yeah, you know, it's sort of important to sort of talk about sort of the other side of sort of this entire discourse. Right, so I guess somewhat related to sort of this topic, my sort of final question, I guess, is, you know, we have all these this sort of spirituality-based business that's come under criticism in Japan, as sort of I've been talking about. And often, you know, because, as you've mentioned too, this is because all these businesses are judged in relation to, air quotes, religion, right? And this is obviously problematic, as you've also discussed. But you provide a case study, or at least an example that I find really interesting, what you call the spirituality ditchers, Datsu Spiritual, right? Yeah. Can you talk about sort of these people and how do they see, or how do they understand the economic aspects of spirituality business?
Right. So chapter six, yes, goes on this the critiques, right, of all these. And at some point in 2016, I think it was 2015, and I was looking into all kinds of blogs about people criticizing basically spiritual therapists. And of course, the criticism is old, but you always find it in scholarly, as you said, you know, work or journalistic work. But you rarely find it in, at least until then, so out loud in blogs by people who had been originally, let's say, very fond of these therapies. So I looked into, I got a research grant for a project to look into this particular topic that eventually led me to actually look also into the legal aspects that since last year have suddenly become even more relevant. But this particular Datsu Spiritual as a kind of keyword that came up on Twitter first, I think in 2012, and then later mostly in blogs of not many people, actually. As I mentioned, you know, there's a lot of blogs out there and articles and et cetera, but they're actually produced by very few people, as is always the case in social media. But these particular people had a very interesting approach in that they kind of agreed with the rest of the critics of spiritual therapies and the business in general. So the sociologists that blamed, you know, these therapists for, as you said, duping their clients, or the journalists who looked into the money. These people who had been fond of spiritual therapies, but suddenly changed their mind and thought that the salons are mostly, in general, bad for you, had the same argument, which was, you know, if something is good for you, you shouldn't be having to pay so much money for it, basically. So it was a kind of a capitalist critique. The difference was, of course, in a sense, and perhaps it's not that different, but this is another story. But the difference was that they didn't criticize the need for this kind of spiritual therapies or spirituality in general. They criticized the way that these transactions happened, or the fact that people would get so-called addicted to this and would basically constantly try to find the new therapies, the new technique, you know, the new kind of trend, and spend so much money without really realizing what they consider to be, you know, the fact that spirituality is for you to be a better person, basically, and that should be all, not something to consume, let's say, right? So it was interesting to look into this critique, because I thought it had so much to do with the latter half of the chapter, which is really about the lawyers and the critiques of the spiritual business as some kind of scam and some kind of fraud. And I found it very interesting that on a legal perspective, up till at least last year, none of these, if someone doing this kind of therapy would go to court or would have a legal issue, let's say, these issues were never really dealt because they had a particular religious character to them, but because they were dealt as consumer issues, basically. Yet some people tried and they managed indeed in 2018 and enacted in 2019 this new kind of section in the Consumer Contract Act where you have reika and shoho, this spiritual sales, this term becoming suddenly a legal term that characterizes and describes, supposed to describe any kind of a fraudulent, let's say, transaction based on this sales technique that, you know, puts fear into you in order to get you to buy something that is whose powers or whose effects are based on things that are not provable in scientific terms, let's say. So what the teachers criticized and what the, let's say, the lawyers or the analysts criticized in the speech of therapies, I thought stemmed from a very kind of common moral imperatives of, you know, sincerity and the fact that, you know, when you buy something, you need to have enough information about it. And otherwise it would go against the laws, something like that, right? So there is this basic framework that we all work in and which influences the way that we criticize certain transactions as criminal or fraudulent or not. And I think that's obviously a question that continues, and this is actually the project that I've been working since last year, even before that, on trying to look into the history of what these spiritual sales are and how they have come up as a new legal category and how since obviously last July they have made the news and led to a new regulations regarding the monetary transactions with religious institutions or non-institutions, basically. So it's an ongoing project, let's say, but chapter six, it kind of starts the discussion, hopefully.
Definitely. Thank you for sharing that. I think it's a very, especially sort of here recently in Japan, right? Sort of this idea of there's a corrupt sort of religiosity, again, air quotes, and how that sort of plays a part in like the law and sort of legal system. You know, that's recently entered the public discourse again with sort of the assassination of Shinzo Abe, and people start talking about like all these new religions and everything. So it's definitely a very sort of even now very sort of contemporary sort of topic. But yeah, we've taken much of your time today. And usually we'd ask our guests to sort of talk about their current projects, and you've talked about that, so that's great. Thank you. For everyone who's sort of interested in learning more about sort of spirituality and through the therapist and everything, please do check out Dr. Gaitorini's book, and also look forward to his sort of latest projects. And I'll see you on another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies. Goodbye.